Welcome to Tax Breaks, a podcast by the Federation of Tax Administrators, where we delve into current subjects and their relevance to the realm of tax administration. Each episode of our podcast features conversations with esteemed professionals from government, academia, and the private sector. Our guests generously share their wealth of knowledge and unique perspectives, providing invaluable insights and expertise to our listeners. I'm Ryan Minnick, FTA's Chief Operating Officer, and this episode I'm joined by the immediate past IRS Commissioner, Charles or Chuck Rettig. Chuck is a friend of FTA. He was very engaged during his time as commissioner, really sought feedback from the states. He actually just presented at our FTA annual meeting of tax commissioners in June in Long Beach, California. So this conversation, super excited to have. We spent a little bit, almost the next full hour, just talking about his time at the IRS, the challenges of COVID, and what he sees in the future and how he, how he feels about the profession of tax administration and what he's doing now, even after his time as commissioner, to continue to, help support tax administrators in the United States and promote the incredible work that they do. So without further ado, here's my conversation with former Commissioner Rettig. Welcome, Commissioner Rettig. Really excited to talk to you today.
Ryan, I appreciate being here. Thank you. Thank the FTA and thank all the states for really everything you do. I'm sure we'll have some conversation here about it, but while I was commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, it was not lost on us the importance of our state partners and the FTA in terms of communications, getting the word out both ways so that we could receive information. And there, there's not time in a podcast to say it, but we're very aware of, as we would move or not move, the impact we would have on state tax administration. And I think FTA really was at the center of that in terms of helping us. So, from myself, Chuck Rettig personally, but also as, the former commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, and on behalf of every IRS employee, thank you. Huge thank you to the FTA. Huge thank you to the states. We went through COVID together.
Well, I appreciate that, Commissioner Rettig. This is a, Chuck. This is an important partnership for us. Oh, Chuck, of course, sorry. And this is an important partnership for us. And we really appreciated all of your engagement during your time as commissioner, where you would come and speak with the individual tax commissioners from the states and join us at our annual meeting. In fact, you just joined us a few weeks ago as we're recording this at our annual meeting in Long Beach, where you shared kind of a perspective from looking back on your time as IRS commissioner. And you could have heard a pin drop in the room the entire time. It was a really riveting talk. So really appreciate you not only taking the time to share your perspective, but over the years, all of the work and the time that you took to hear the state's perspective. And, a lot of people like to think that the IRS and state revenue agencies are exactly the same kind of functioning body. And I think what, at least what I learned in my time in this world is that, we are very different organizations aligned around the same end customer, which is the taxpayer, but we go about our work a little bit differently. And so that collaboration is so incredibly important. So getting into our conversation, I was just wondering if you would take a minute. I know, we've talked many times, you actually have shared with me before, you kind of left your dream job to come to take the job of the commissioner of the IRS, which, I think based on media coverage from any angle is not necessarily the most glamorous job in the world. You have an organization going through massive transformation. You have, you had COVID during your tenure. What was that decision like, and how did you feel kind of stepping into that world?
I was a tax lawyer in Los Angeles for 36 years. I had chaired at an earlier point the IRS Advisory Council. I'd been on advisory boards, advisory council in California for the Franchise Tax Board, which is the income tax arm, State Board of Equalization, for more than 20 years. And sort of, I was raised as a tax professional that tax professionals give back to the tax community and try to help everybody. And so whether we get our paychecks from the government or the private side is almost irrelevant. Just try to do the right thing. Try to make it better. And particularly try to be the voice for those who don't have a voice. Most taxpayers don't have a voice. Going on board the Internal Revenue Service obviously was a huge privilege for anyone. I pride myself in saying I'm a public school kid out of Los Angeles. First in my family to go to college. My father, came to the United States from Germany, went into the Navy upon graduating high school. I have a son who's major in the Army today and who deployed twice. And all of this ties in, and then also My wife, as many people know, came into this country as a refugee from Vietnam. She's a boat person in November 1981. And I get the opportunity to go to move from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., and be commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service at a point in my life where I could. I was in my dream job with my best friends for 36 years, never thought I would have the opportunity to be so passionate about what I was doing every day. And the IRS was my prior passion, times a thousand. Was so happy to be at the IRS, trying to make things better, work with everybody, work with the employees, interact with the states, find the problems, and to do our best to try to address the problem. And then we ran into COVID, right? In the end of 19, beginning of 20, ran into COVID. Many people since have said, Ryan, imagine what you could have done at IRS without COVID. And my response was, well, if you're going to go work someplace, I think you want to be there during the worst times, not the best of times. And what we saw during COVID, well, I'll speak to the IRS workforce initially. I saw the best of the best. I saw people who really helped figure out a workaround on issues that, like the states, we had resource issues and the rest. And people were coming up with what otherwise might have been, wild, crazy ideas that worked, right? And I'm not a risk-averse guy, and we had to accomplish certain missions, and we did. And it was really because of the innovation and the creativity and the efforts of the people at the IRS, as well as people at the states. We were heavily engaged with the state tax administrators. We're heavily engaged with you and with the FTA. What can we do? What do you think we need to do? I remember in March of 2020, reaching out to tax professionals, to the states, to FTA, to all kinds of places, saying, what do you think we can do? What do you want us to do? We are going to do everything that we can do that I don't have to change the Internal Revenue Manual, and I don't have to go to Treasury and ask for. And if you go back and you look at the People's First Initiative of March of 2020, that came together in about 10 days. We froze payments, we froze interest, we did everything we can do to help the country. Let people focus on themselves, their personal situation, and we should not be the reason they wake up in the middle of the night. And some of the things there, in the ordinary sense, a tax administrator would never think of, and that was just the beginning foundation for what we tried to do throughout COVID. But we did that, I think people are aware, we did that hand in hand with the states. And we all know our priorities.
Yeah.
We knew what was there. And I think history will be very kind to the IRS and state tax administrators of how they dealt with it.
I think so. I mean, I think, to your point, I almost, in the, so I've been in this role at FTA. It'll be 9 years here in a few weeks. And over that time, my background's technology, so I always look through the lens of modernization and how we're responding to things, COVID was the single largest quantum leap forward in government adoption of technology and experimentation and pilots. And it was, single biggest leap forward ever. I mean, really since the space race, if you really want to kind of compare, a moment in time where we really invested heavily in technology and tried to that level of innovation. And what we saw outside of the technology in the States and with your team at the IRS was people who were passionate patriots who wanted to do the best they could do for their fellow citizens, and efficiency metrics went through the roof. I mean, every measurable output of a revenue agency during that time was the best it's ever been at a time where the work format was completely different. The technologies were completely different. We were all learning how to use Zoom. We were all trying to figure out how to securely communicate with taxpayers. People were standing up secure portals in a way that respected data privacy and security. All these things were happening. And people rose to that challenge, and it was the leaders of those agencies, yourself and the tax commissioners of the states, that saw the opportunity to kind of steer that energy and help us get through. And that was a beautiful thing to watch from FTA's perspective, as the organization here to support all of you and tax administrators and doing the work you do.
We got $3.5 billion in COVID money that we were never going to get, and we had chief counsel looked at every spend, but it allowed us to go from about 16% telework eligible to over 92% telework eligible in a handful of months, right there in the summer of 2020. We never would have gotten there. Today, the agency would not be there. And so COVID, obviously horrendous, you know, on a personal scale, personal basis. But we got funding that we were never going to get. We were smart with the funding. It was all about technology and service, right? How can we use the money we have in a smart way to take the agency, if you will, from a mostly paper-based agency, analog agency, to a digital virtual environment so that we could today serve taxpayers better who want to operate in that digital virtual environment without losing our really respect and care and concern for the folks who are either more comfortable or need in-person paper and all that. You know, it's easily forgotten in the United States that there's tens of millions of people that don't have broadband, they don't have a smartphone. Languages, they're not comfortable in the English language. They're not comfortable dealing with a tax administrator. We went wholesale into languages, and the driver really was COVID. Our announcement, and Ryan, you've heard me say this, but our outreach materials for the first round of economic impact payments, March 27, 2020, we had our announcement in English. We were instructed in the statute, get these payments out as rapidly as possible. I got a call from some folks on the outside, the Internal Revenue Service, who said, your friends want to help, how can we help? And I said, well, we have outreach materials in English. And the comment was, yeah, okay. You know. And I said, I need them in as many different languages as you can get them to me. That was on a Tuesday. The following Tuesday, I got back our outreach materials in 35 different languages, which we covered the country in. Imagine going into some of the communities here. You have a lot of folks who end up in the United States that left a hostile government. Imagine going in saying, I'm from the IRS, file a tax return, I can get you $1,200. They're like, well, we heard that before, right? Getting into their language and presenting it to them with people from the community saying, hey, here's what it is. And to do that times 35 different languages, not only, I think, did it earn us a lot of respect in the communities, but internally, you know, about 37% of IRS employees are first-generation immigrants. Our employees saw, hey, look what we're doing, if you will, for my people, right? It was a huge morale boost that we started focusing, if you will, on the fact that we live in the United States of America, right? With a recognition that a lot of people come in from other countries for a variety of reasons, and take pride in the fact that we can serve them too in their language that they're most comfortable. That's what led to the 2019 Form 1040 we launched in Spanish in 2020. I got on board at the end of 2018. We did the 2019 1040 income tax return in Spanish, the first time the agency ever did an income tax return in a language other than English. And they're going to be in 8 different languages. And I think everybody needs to get there. The idea is to help the people who are trying to get it right. And I got pushback internally. Oh, it costs us more money for this or that. And my response was, well, how much does it cost when somebody who's not comfortable in the language files something, when then they're calling us and then they're sending in letters and multiple calls? Why don't we get in where they're comfortable on the front end, come in, and maybe they get it right in that same 2019 return? And I don't mean to capture this podcast with this, but things that I think we should all be proud about. We had a Schedule LEP. A taxpayer could check one of 20 boxes and tell us what language they wanted to interact with the IRS in writing. And you hit that box, we coded your file, if you will, everything out from us went in that language, up to 20 different languages. Honestly, that all started with COVID. And then the passion for the employees to serve, if you know, I don't know if the right way to say it, but the communities that they identify with in a big way. And so it all built on itself.
Well, and making things more accessible does nothing. I mean, it's the golden, you know, the golden rule of tax administration, right? The more you can encourage voluntary compliance, you know, the people who want to get it right, just like you say, the better off we are, because it's less resources downstream. People file accurate, honest tax returns, it passes through the digital audits faster, it clears inspection faster, the risk of fraud is reduced if they're filing timely, like all of these things that, then you have, less of a differentiation between fraud and underreporting or accidental or people who can't follow the directions. I mean, making that information more accessible is such a, it is an incredible shift to see. And I don't, until the first time you had shared that with me a couple of years ago, I was not aware that prior to 2020, we didn't have a 1040 in, any other language. I mean, it's remarkable that that it was 2020 before we had that, but how great that we accelerate, 2020 to now and have it in 8. I mean, it just shows the speed at which we can move when we're aligned.
Well, we live in the United States of America. We have technology companies here. I went into Austin, Texas, in the Silicon Valley with a pitch of you need to help us. You wouldn't be who you are if you were founded, formed, and operated in a country that doesn't have the rule of law and the civilization that we do here. And we need help. We need help from you from a technology perspective. And they were extremely helpful. They understood, right? And the other side of this, Ryan, on the touching the languages again, it's showing respect for the people who are here and who are trying to get it right. And I would just say for those who are listening, thinking about getting, their own state maybe into other languages, it was such a morale boost inside the IRS that was sort of the subsidiary part of it. Had I thought of it as that, we probably would have gone there anyway, right? Was not nearly a heavy lift as I think others might have projected. And listening to the people on the front lines, whether it's our own people, IRS agents and whatnot on the front lines, or people on the call centers, the states, just people's when you go out to dinner, you go to a diner and somebody's saying something. Listening to that and the ability to bring that in and challenge the people in the agency to do better. Can we do this? Rather than how we've always done it. I'm not a, we've always done it this way, so let's just continue on, which is really a mindset that tries to avoid mistakes. And that was not us. But COVID gave us cover to try everything that we wanted. And certainly we made some mistakes. I made some mistakes. But the vast majority of things we tried are now ingrained in the service, in the Internal Revenue Service, and in the relationships that we developed. With the states and with foreign tax ministers. There were things that were pitched to us. There are foreign countries where basically use a thumbprint or a palm print and you can file your tax return. I believe the United States is not yet ready for that. The Big Brother concepts that go behind it. But technology is there and you have to pick and choose where you want to be, where you need to be. And the tax administrators and the IRS commissioners and similar that I'm really most impressed with are the ones that can see forward, not backward. Backward, that's yesterday. Where we need to be, let's get there. And as we operated, we saw where we thought we needed to be. We made our efforts to get there. If we didn't get there, we didn't stop. We figured that our process from point A to point B was somehow flawed. Let's analyze the flawless process, and then let's go after it again. And that really was, I think, the mindset that we gave to everyone at the Internal Revenue Service. And once you start turning over the reins to people, if you have the right people in the position, trust them to do their job, monitor, but you'll find that the employees can be incredibly innovative. And quite frankly, they saved the Internal Revenue Service during COVID.
On people having that level of ownership over, solving the problem or rising to the challenge was unprecedented. It was this terrible, horrible, no good, very bad thing that was happening globally. But, people could, in these kind of critical roles, leverage the energy that they had that they didn't know where else to put it. No, at least I'm not a, a biochemist or, a vaccine creator or anything like that. So, my energy could go into helping technology modernization initiatives and, advising and getting convening the states to talk about the challenges they were experiencing. And actually, that's one of the things, I guess, before we kind of exit the COVID period of your time at the IRS, I think one of the things that you did during COVID especially, and then even continued it on throughout, was this level of communication and check-in with the states. And we've talked a lot about the deadline movement that came up pretty early in the pandemic. And I just, I I think that's such a prescient thing to recognize that, you were aware of the type of impact, and you had done that outreach and through us at certain stages and directly with some of the larger states to determine like how to navigate that water. And what was that like? Because that was, I mean, the movement of a deadline to that extent was really unprecedented prior to that point. So how did you tackle that?
We were under intense pressure from the Hill, people up on the Capitol, senators and congresspeople, to move the filing deadlines from April 15 to October 15, March 15 to September 15, both for 2020 and 2021, and estimated tax payments and all that. Just push it all out. If you push the can down the road, and large tax professional organizations feel that they have a say in Congress. I had one say that, over 70% of the members of Congress have their tax returns prepared by people who are part of our organization, and Congress wants you to do this, extend, let's say, the Form 1040 date from April 15 to October 15. A lot of states happen to be on a June 30 fiscal year. If we were going to, and their filing deadlines are automatically tied to ours. If we were to push beyond June 30, we would be impacting the budgets for quite a few states in the country. We were aware of that. This was under the time that Secretary Mnuchin was there, and he would go out someplace and come back and say, this big, powerful senator wants us to move the filing date. And he says, essentially, I leave it up to you. And he said, why would we not? I go, the states. I said, we got to protect the states. We got to get money in, filing brings in money. Filing and payment run together, get payments in. And he says, do not move. And he always was the guy, do not move the filing date, right? And then he'd go tell people, he wouldn't give them an answer why, but he would say, we're not. Commissioner Rettig has made a determination. I support his determination. This is where we are. And you can only imagine if we... I'm sitting in California today. If if California's filing date was tied to IRS, and California is on a June 30, and we moved it past June 30, their entire budget for this year is off, and their budget for the next fiscal year is off, and so we had to be aware of what we were doing. I like to say aware of the impact we have when we do make a move, and the impact we have when we don't make a move. And then balance, priorities, impacts, and all the rest. But I know that a lot of folks go to Congress to get Congress to lean on the IRS or Treasury. And I have to be thankful that my time, I served equally under two different administrations, under the Trump administration and the Biden administration. And during my time, we had complete support from the administrations and certainly from the Treasuries. And I'll just say, I operated the IRS. We referred to Treasury as our neighbors. I really didn't care what our neighbors, we would listen, but I didn't take instructions from our neighbors. And the only person who could fire me was the President of the United States, send me back from Washington, D.C. to my home in Los Angeles, to my friends, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't such a bad thing in my head to be, gosh, if I got fired for, in my mind, doing the right thing. And I used to say, and many of the state tax administrators, when I were around them, I'd say, listen, if I get fired for the rest of my life, I'll look at my wife, and we have four children between us, we'll be extremely proud for what we did. And we're going to do the right thing here. And that's what I told the employees. We're going to do the right thing. We're not listening to anybody else's agenda. And we did that also under COVID. And we did it with things, from a filing deadline to generation of payments. If I can touch on generation of economic impact payments is somewhat related to something that's going on now at the IRS. So IRS suspended processing of employee retention credits, right? Congress, as part of the CARES Act in 2020, said, okay, employers, pay your employee, and we're going to backfill that by giving you a credit, essentially on a ratio basis, for the amount you paid your employee. But we want to keep people employed. It was the fastest mechanism to get money to employers to keep people employed. Well, you find out today, IRS has 1.4 million ERC claims that have not been paid. And saying, well, we think there's fraud there, and we've analyzed a million of them and whatnot. And so I've said publicly, and I've said to Danny Werfel, who's commissioner, and others, we had that same concern. On the first round of economic impact payments in March 2020, We knew there were going to be bad actors trying to get payments of up to $1,200 each. We knew that that was going to happen. And we balanced, if you will, the fraud with the country was at a standstill. We need to get this money out to people who, for the first time, lost a job, lost a business, unemployed, you know, missed car payment, missed an apartment payment. And beyond the economic impact of the $1,200, we were also very aware that when we could direct deposit in March of 2020 up to $1,200 into somebody's bank account, that person was going to wake up, look in their bank account, and realize their government cares for them, right? Without any interaction, we did hundreds of millions of direct deposits into people's accounts. And so our employees knew the economics is important, but the emotional part, the whole world and the country were facing COVID. And I think proudly our employees got to play a part of helping the emotions. And we knew we were going to have bad actors. We knew there was going to be fraud. And we'll go after the fraudsters later. So that's, I think, a classic example of how we looked at least balancing risk of bad actors, with trying to do the right thing. And we did not shut down payments. We did round one of economic impact payments in exactly 2 weeks, record setting, hundreds of millions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of payments, hundreds of billions of dollars. We did round two in 48 hours, 147 million payments, $142 billion. 48 hours after the president signed. Round three, we did in 24 hours. Total of 500 million payments, $830 billion of payments from an agency that was essentially shut down, going from, you know, sitting in the seat in the office to a virtual environment to digital and the rest. And I give the credit to the workforce. The employees saw it and went for it. And I think similarly, you know, the states were sort of, if you will, a shadow of us and helped us make our decisions on, again, what to do or what not to do. And I think that collectively, state tax administrators and, you know, IRS employees really are to be credited with, you know, from our perspective, saving our piece of the world during a bad time, right? I know, obviously, state, you know, how many people really like the tax guy, right? I get that. But I think we help people look at tax people differently. That, you know, I said to Congress, you didn't go to the VA or the SSA to issue these, and they already had the infrastructure. You came to us, and we did it, right? You know, there's a connection between what happened then and the fact that the IRS got $80 billion of IRA funding, you know, since cut to $60 billion. But it's different. I think the look at tax administration is different when you see how they step in times of crisis to try to make things better.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and what you're describing at, you know, slightly, you know, obviously a different scale is what we saw across countless states that had similar programs, similar economic impact programs or assistance programs that, again, you're right, they went to the revenue agency. They said, you know, we want you to administer this. And many of those revenue agencies, you know, didn't have, you know, no one had infrastructure to do this. No one had contemplated the size, scope, and scale of these types of assistance programs during a global pandemic that shut everything down. I mean, that's just the notion that anyone, any agency, I mean, your agency doing it in a couple of weeks, the states doing it in the timeframes they managed to accomplish it. I mean, you have a, you know, we had a regular Zoom call of tax commissioners during the pandemic that was an opportunity for them to share what was going on in their agencies and try to help each other problem solve, whether it was remote work challenges or, you know, going back to the office when it was time for that, or, you know, whether it was, you know, how to serve taxpayers if they didn't have certain systems in place and they needed to put them in place. And the thing that always emerged from that is just the nobility of the profession of tax administration. People don't recognize, I often think, and I think you made the point really well a couple of minutes ago, talking about, you know, you served under two administrations, two different political administrations. And it kind of, to me, it's exemplary of the fact that we talk about this quite frequently. Tax administration is inherently nonpartisan. Tax administration picks up once tax code, tax law has been passed. The lawmaking process, of course, can be very political. That's up to the legislators and the people who work on those things. But once that's written and signed and handed off to the tax administrators, it doesn't matter, you know, where it came from. The process was followed, and now it has to be administered. And that at least makes, I think, the work that revenue agencies do, regardless of the political status of the state, or the party affiliation, any of that. It's inherently nonpartisan work, and that, I appreciate you calling attention to that, because that's, I think that's why tax administration works so well. I mean, they're working for everybody. I mean, you gotta administer the code fairly and equally to the best of your ability.
We weren't independent, Democrat, Republican. We were proud Americans, right? And trying to do our piece, if you will, there. And people can go back and look at my testimony in Ways and Means in the Senate, and you'll see me calling it out. If ever somebody said, us Democrats or us Republicans, I'd lean into it and say, I'd rather be sitting here and have you say you're a proud American. And, it's crystal clear. It's for the betterment of the country. And I never, neither administration, neither the Trump administration nor the Biden administration ever reached into us. They interact with Treasury, and Treasury does tax policy, which again is under the administration. But there's a significant wall between us and them. We administer the law that is passed by Congress, signed by a president, so-called enacted, and we administer the law as the law is stated and the courts interpret. It's pretty simple, right?
So exiting, the COVID period kind of tapered off. The world started to change again. What was, in that, with respect to that, the first couple of years of your term, going into the pandemic, the last couple of years of term coming out of the pandemic, and then beginning to orient the organization for, further, I won't even say new historical transformation, further historical transformation. I mean, the IRA funding was inbound.
Yeah, the IRA came in August 16, 2022, and my term by statute ended November 12, 2022. So, we got that money.
How, as you were going towards the end of your term, orienting, the organization for, for your successor, how were you thinking about, the, COVID in your rearview mirror, all the, all the things that you had accomplished? I mean, what was your kind of takeaway that you were leaving, your legacy that you hope you left the agency with?
So, a lot of times people used to ask me, what's your leadership style? And I said, well, I don't have a leadership style. I care about people. I care about the people in my room. I care about the people that we serve. I care about the people in the country. And when I got asked questions that use the word legacy, typically I would say, well, my legacy, I got my wife and our four kids. They're all, healthy, happy, working hard. I've got a son who's a major in the United States Army who has deployed twice, raised here in Los Angeles, and he's seen parts of the world that you hope nobody sees, but sometimes you think everybody should see. So they bring home really the value that this country does provide to people. And, obviously, I think I said earlier, my wife was 17 when she escaped Vietnam, and, 9 days at sea on a 27-foot boat with 101 people. And, her life stories gave a lot of hope to us and stuff. And so when I look back, and I look back at the agency, I don't look at an institution. I look at the people that ran the agency, the people who were there with me, the people who were there before me, and the people that will come forward. And what we were really trying to do, and I would routinely say, we need to make it better for the next person sitting in your seat does not have to deal with all the distractions you need to deal with. I'm a commissioner. Tell me what we need to do to make your little piece, if you will, of IRS operations better, and we're going to do that. And then at some time that you move on, the next person will be more efficient in their role. And so I think I'm safe to say that, 95% of the employees would say that this guy had their back 1,000%. I did. I cared and care a lot about the employees. And I've said to Commissioner Werfel, we talk frequently, you can get all the money you want in the world. You can modernize the agency all you want in the world with technology, software, hardware, and the rest. If the employees don't feel valued and respected, either intentionally or unintentionally, they could slow walk implementation of what you're trying to do. Whereas we saw and lived when we showed them the respect that they deserved, their creativity, their innovation skills, and their just pride in getting things better made the whole agency better. What we were able to do without funding, the IRS should make you know, giant leaps forward with the money that's there. And you know, it irritates me when I see Congress coming at IRS to reduce the amount of money IRS has, or says IRS isn't efficient. I can throw statistics all day long to say it's one of the most efficient government agencies on the planet, and you know, so all that. But really, you know, legacy, the fact that I had the privilege and opportunity of working with some really amazing people and helping them, I think, become all they could be, would be, I hope, maybe, I don't know if that's the right word, legacy for that, but when I look back, that's my pride factor, my time at the agency, and then the outreach, you know, going into languages, going into communities. I think you're aware, I guess normally a commissioner has a ceremony at IRS headquarters in D.C. where former commissioners and members of Congress, you know, people from Treasury or whatever come in and, you know, oh, thank you for what you did, and a lot of pictures and all that. And literally everybody told me I needed to do that, and I did not. I went out to the field and met with the people on the front lines, whether they're answering phones, auditing taxpayers, collecting, doing HR, whatever. Went out to the front lines and thanked every one of them for allowing me the privilege to be on board with them during that period of time, and reminding them that we got $80 billion, and a lot of people are going to come through that door and tell you they got you that $80 billion, but they didn't. You got it yourself. You got it because of who you are, what you do, the agency you work for, and the care factor for the people around you, and making it better. And you did it, and Congress rewarded that. So, you know, stay proud. And I used to always say, and we want your children, we want your grandchildren, we're hiring, you know, kind of a thing. And to really instill pride. And when I look at it now, you know, coming up 18 months later, 1,000% right decision. Could I have done both? I could have, but I was making a statement that it's not about the executives or people with titles. It's about the people who have the oars in the water that make an agency and give the respect that an agency deserves. And it was important to me to go out and thank them. And on some of these, you know, there were times that my wife came out. We went into a tax professional / IRS employee meeting in New Orleans, 150 folks, all of Vietnamese heritage. We brought my wife in, and it was as though I wasn't there. You know, she was the first lady of the IRS, and people in the Vietnamese culture, pretty much by and large, all have the same background that my wife did. And their pride of seeing, dang, the commissioner's wife, as my daughter would say, is authentic. Not only Vietnamese, she's from there, and she's a boat person, and you know, she had all the hardships that particular journey was aware of. And a city councilwoman came in for the city of New Orleans, who also was a Vietnamese boat person. And they were in the middle of the room, and my wife was trying to explain my wife's pride in meeting a city councilwoman from Vietnam, but in New Orleans, who, if you will, made it, right? And you see something like that, you realize different people, different cultures, no matter how they come in the room, they all want to be proud of who they are. And we really worked hard to take that to, there's 87,000 employees when I was there. We wanted that on a person by person by person basis. I wanted every one of them to know. In COVID, we obviously stopped a lot of the traveling. We did a Zoom, which was called Talk Story with Chuck. Up to 150 employees all around the world. We had people from Guam, people from you know, South America. No agenda, 1 hour. Tell me anything they want to talk about. We talked about barbecue. We talked about, you know, making hamburgers and stuff. I had employees cry on our phone systems. They were crying. We prepared them for how to answer a call and talk about their economic impact payment and getting a refund. Those calls almost instantly went to, I lost my husband, I lost my job. We did not fully prepare our people for the therapy side of these, what these calls were going to be. And by having these calls, or these Zoom calls, it allowed us to catch up where we had been remiss and see certain things. And I will say, I'm a huge supporter of this for all the states, if you're thinking of it. Every call was an hour. The shortest call we ever did, I think, was 2 hours, 45 minutes. We outwaited the employees. We waited till there were no more questions. And whatever they wanted to talk about, didn't matter. I helped employees on resumes. If they're in one lane and they wanted to do something else, draft a resume, send it to me. Ken Corbin, who, you know, FTA is very familiar with Ken, was also on these Zoom calls with us. Send us your resumes. And Ken used to always say, you're applying for three different positions, send three different resumes, right? They should be different. And Ken and I were editing resumes for employees during COVID who wanted a different lane, right? Not because that's the official role of a commissioner. It's the right thing to do. If you care about the people that you work with, you want them in a better place. What I used to say, I don't want them to leave. I want to turn jobs into careers. And a career is something, when you go to your neighbor's house for dinner, you say, do you know what I'm doing? Do you know where I work? Do you know who I work with? Do you know what we did? That's what I wanted to bring into their households. And indirectly, every agency has trouble hiring. You hire through the people you have. If they have a good relationship with the agency, they'll be out talking to their friends saying, you know, you ought to think of coming on board. And also they'll stay. So I apologize for the long-winded answer. But really, to me, I went in for, you know, the people in state tax administration, the people inside the IRS, taxpayers, tax professionals and all, and see if we can make it better. And I hope that we had even a small part of moving the dial in the right direction.
No, I think, you know, not long-winded at all. I think that's, you know, the amazing answer. And it shows, it underscores your, you know, what you've continued to do. I mean, coming to our conferences and in other work that you have going on now, just continuing to support that message of tax administrators being, you know, patriots and true, you know, true noble. It's a noble calling to be a tax administrator and to do that work and to fairly and equitably administer the tax code and reach as many taxpayers as possible and do it in a coherent way. I mean, it's just been, I know you've continued that work even beyond. So, I mean, to even call it legacy is probably, you know, it's more of a semicolon as opposed to a period. So
I think I'm only halfway through my life, right? I'm 67. I think I have another 67 years left, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's you know, something ongoing. So you've and what I so appreciate is that, you know, you can tell when someone loves what they do and they when they continue to do it even though they don't have to do it anymore. And certainly that, so you know, from your engagement with us and talking with other groups, that's what you've continued to do. So I guess in our last couple of minutes together, you know, I was curious, like, you know, anything you're working on now that you want to share with our listeners and plug or talk about, and then we'll wrap up.
So commissioner has a statutory term, and then for 2 years after, as you know, as a tax lawyer before and interacting with the government, for 2 years after I leave the IRS, I'm not allowed to interact with the IRS in a manner that might influence, which I think, I don't know how IRS interprets it. I interpret it as everything, so I don't interact with the IRS on matters. I poke them. I tell them where they're wrong, and I cheerlead. I tell them where they're right, and I have a lot of personal conversations with a lot of employees. But in the meantime, I've been very active in anti-human trafficking organization, Women and Children, creating a network for the country because human trafficking has no boundaries. And I think my passion there is rivals my passion, you know, for the IRS. I'm also hugely active with a number of crypto crime fighters, folks who did it with us at IRS or Department of Justice, who now have their own operations. Most of these are 5-7 person operations, but the ability to go after bad guys in the crypto space is close to my heart. And while I was at IRS, just very quickly, we took down, our IRS cyber crimes team took down the largest child exploitation site in the history of the world, 337 arrests, 38 countries, and we rescued 23 actively exploited children. IRS cyber crimes took down financing sites for Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS. We actually got court approval to run them, saw who made contributions, then that generated cases all by itself. We did the largest seizure out of the cloud ever, $3.6 billion. We seized a wallet out of the cloud. And the folks who were doing that work while I was at IRS have since left the government, and they do it in the private sector for governments, you know, friendly governments and whatnot. So They've reached out, and I'm sort of an advisor, if you will, to a lot of those folks. And all of that is really phenomenal, if you will, on the sleep at night factor. And March 1 of this year, I returned to private practice as a tax lawyer with a national firm. It's called Chamberlain Herdlicum. Their principal office is in Houston, but I know they have about 120 tax lawyers. There's 20 people there I've known for 3 decades, so it wasn't really a difficult decision. And we're trying to do the same thing. We're trying to, from that perspective, trying to get people back into compliance, explain the way things are supposed to work and what they're supposed to do. So I've been really privileged in my personal and professional lives. And Ryan, I hugely appreciate you reaching out for the podcast and for you and for the members of FTA. If you guys ever need me someplace, put me in, coach. I can't hit the 3-pointer, but I'm pretty good in the paint, so,
Absolutely. No, I like I we will we definitely have not seen the last of Commissioner Rettig or Chuck at our FTA events. And we really, I mean, appreciate the time and mentorship that you provide so many other tax administrators and just your perspective. It's been a pleasure. It was a pleasure working with you and your commissioner. It's a pleasure working with you now. I really appreciate you taking the time to share with our listeners some of your lessons learned and perspectives. I mean, we talk all the time, and I feel like I've learned a few things today. So, again, appreciate you taking the time, and we'll see you again real soon, as they say.
We could not have done it without the FTA, without the states. Those relationships are critical, and they're also strong. And so, I hope the states all feel the same.